Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Okay, so it's good to start the day with a laugh. I actually have a guest in the studio today, but before I tell you who it is, first I'll tell you who I am. I am Katie Kiefer, and this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. We are live at Roberta's in Bushwick, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. So we start this show with a joys and sorrows segment. Today I actually, as I said, have a guest in the studio, Sari Kamen, who is a longtime Heritage broadcaster herself. And she is kindly joining me today to talk about many things, including our joys and sorrows, but also the Women's March and some ideas around a new show that she's planning and much, much more. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's talk a little bit about those joys and sorrows, Sari. Like I watched the inauguration. I know we were supposed to boycott it, but I watched it. I was with my 94-year-old aunt in Washington.
How could you stomach it, though?
Well, you know, you just, grit your teeth. It was interesting. I mean, from a sociological point of view, it was actually very interesting to watch. It was interesting to see the expressions on everybody's faces. It was interesting to
like watch. Michelle Obama's.
Yeah, right. And Hillary's. And Bill's. It was really interesting when the camera dwelt upon our new president, he who shall not be named, the Twitler. President Twitler.
I think that's my favorite name I've heard so far.
I think so too, right? Yeah.
I was just going to say our new president. Blech.
Yeah. The Cheetolini. I like Cheetolini too. I think that's a pretty good one. But, we're going to have a field. There's a joy right there. We're going to have a freaking field day with this stuff.
We are.
It's comedy gold. If you want to look at it that way, it is, profoundly tragic in reality, but there is comedy gold to be struck from.
Certainly. Michael Moore made that exact point at the rally.
Yes, he did. He did.
He said, we will fight the administration with our army of humor, I think,
yes,
to paraphrase it.
Well, since it's clear that Cheetolini has no sense of humor.
He really has no sense of humor.
None.
You knew he was a sociopath, like, right away, because he never cracked any jokes.
That's right. Yeah, not even. I mean, even Pence seems to have a little more of a glimmer of humor than the Cheetolini. But in any case, there's another joy to be mined from this whole ghastly experience, and that is that the media has regained its prominence as the savior. We can't go as far as savior, but the
not
media,
yet.
But they have gained new prominence as the arbiters of what is truth and what are alternate
facts. It's a lot of responsibility.
It is. Mm-hmm. And I hope they rise to it, but I feel like they will. I was driving back from the march yesterday. I was listening, obviously, to NPR. No, I don't just listen to Heritage.
I was listening to NPR. I was going to say, I don't just listen to NPR.
And they had Jack Schaefer on, who runs Politico, and this was on the media. And he said, this is an opportunity. This is a great opportunity for media to regain its market share, for it to regain the prominence that it deserves and needs to have, and that reporters are going to have to, get off their asses and stop writing about tweets and start talking about policy again and really covering the news instead of the I guess alternate facts. I think in a way that fake news, the alternate facts, it all sort of dovetails together. And what do you think happened there, actually? Why do you think we suddenly not suddenly, but gradually descended into this miasma of alternate facts, which is what the news has been covering for the last basically 4 years at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think the election was a really confusing time. I mean, there was such an outpouring of different perceptions that were happening. And, you know, there's clearly a narrative for every type of person out there. And there's an opportunity for each individual to kind of pick and choose what news they want to read and believe is true, depending on, you know, what their personal politics are. And that is such a fatal flaw of our time. And I've felt during the election, I felt, you know, I was truly gripped with fear reading all of these different stories, which were, some were clearly, well, I shouldn't say clearly, some to me, in my opinion, all of a sudden news is opinion. Some seem to be true and some seem to be fabricated and some seem to be grossly hyperbolic. And there was sort of a lot of responsibility on the individual to sort of discern which was truth and which was alternative truth. And it became very blurred. The lines were very blurred. And, you know, I feel that the liberal media or people of the liberal persuasion have a little bit more, oh, this is going to sound so offensive, more competence in discerning which is actual fact and which is not. But there were so many stories that came out about people who created these fake news, a lot of them just for profit, not necessarily because they were partisan or not, that they tried to appeal more to the liberal sect, and the fake news just didn't take as well, which was an interesting thing to read.
Right, a more skeptical audience on the left wing side than on the right. I think that's very interesting because, you know, if I were a Republican or had I been of that persuasion, I don't see how you could fail to miss the fact that we have the lowest unemployment rate that we've had in decades, not just since before the recession, but. I mean, not just since the recession, but before the recession, and that, you know, healthcare is a right, and I don't think we'll ever go back from that idea, fortunately. That's one thing that even if they repeal it, which looks pretty sure that they will, we will still have that sort of news story implanted on both the right and the left. But, yeah, the credibility of the right wing in glossing over these facts that are facts, and going for this other narrative that America is a smoldering ruin thanks to Obama, you know, I find it extraordinary that people have bought into that, no matter how much they may hear that from Rush Limbaugh and, you know, Laura Ingraham and all the rest of those jackals on that side of the media. I don't know. It's a very interesting question, which will undoubtedly be parsed out in the coming 4 years.
Yeah, and I wonder if there's ever going to be any sort of accountability. I mean, yeah. I do feel like fake news was a huge factor in why the election resulted in the way it did.
I agree.
And there was a New York Times article this past week that came out. I don't know if you read about a 23-year-old young individual who created a fake news story about pre-marked ballots for Hillary.
I didn't see that. No.
Yeah, he's 23 and he saw an opportunity to make some money and he bought a domain for like, what, $7?
Yeah.
And called it like the Christian News or Christian Hair. I don't know, something. And he created a story about how, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of pre-marked ballots were discovered in an Ohio warehouse. And he like Googled ballots and found an image from Poland and threw the image up. And he was like, well, if there's an image, surely people won't doubt the credibility. And he was right. And that, wow. And that story got shared over 50,000 times.
Amazing. But then there's also the fact that the New York Times, for example, covered those effing emails ad nauseum.
That's right.
There was no there. Yeah. It was just like
like
Whitewater, you know, there was no there.
Yeah.
And yet even the mainstream left wing or, you know, at least centrist media continued to harp on that rather than cover the stories about Trump University and, you know, all of the other ways in which this man has conned and lied and stolen from people all over the world. I mean, that's where I feel like the accountability really, I mean, they need to be held accountable for that, I think. And I think that other major newspapers followed their lead in that sense, that they continued to cover stories that were not stories. Yes. And I'm not sure who they thought they were appealing to by doing that. And they certainly didn't seem to have any idea of what the consequences would be. Well, now they're going to find out.
Well, now they know.
Yeah. Well, they're really going to find out when Trump starts rolling back freedom of the press.
Oof,
you know, starts denying them access to the White House. And you saw that incredible, I don't even know what to call it, a press briefing. I don't know what it was, when Sean Spicer came out on Saturday.
And just vomited a bunch of lies and took no questions and left. Yeah.
Yeah, it was
I don't know what the name of that is.
I don't know either of my answers.
Like so many things, it is both unprecedented and unprecedented.
Yes, absolutely. Well, should we take a break? I think we've exhausted our joys and sorrows. We'll just take a break.
Where was the joys part?
the joys is first of all our new
The humor.
Alternate facts.
Right.
Twitler.
Oh, we didn't even speak of Kellyanne.
We did not speak of Kellyanne. But
I
think it's okay.
Let's not speaking of Kellyanne.
Let's not give her any more airtime. Let's go to break and have our sponsor drop with New York Grown and Certified. Please tell me if I get that right, Vitor. I never, ever, ever get it right. In fact, I was going to ask Sari to remember it for me so at the end of the show I can thank them again correctly, as I never do.
I'll do my best.
But we'll be right back after this, and we're going to talk about some new ideas, both here and abroad. Stay tuned.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are talking today. I am talking today. You are listening today to my friend and not co-host, but fellow, my colleague, Sari Kamen from The Morning After.
Hello.
Thank you for coming in today.
Oh, it feels great to be on this side of the microphone.
Yeah.
Well, same side of the microphone, different side of the table,
yeah,
I guess.
That's right. And, you know, we both just got back from the Women's March in D.C.
Yeah.
And so I thought we could talk a little bit about that because it was such an epic experience. I am so happy that I went to D.C., not to belittle any of the other marches, because I think the march in New York, which was nowhere near as well organized, or not, I shouldn't say well organized, but nowhere near as planned, had probably close to as many marchers as we did in D.C. I felt like there were a million people there. I really did. Didn't you?
I absolutely felt that way. I heard that number. I don't know if that...
Michael Moore said it, and then one of the other people said it.
But I saw it on CNN. I mean, I don't know if, you know, we'll ever really know exactly what the number is, but it doesn't matter. I mean, all I know is as far as I could see, every single street in Washington, D.C., was flooded with people. It was a sea of pink pussy hats as far as the eye could see, and it was a glorious sight to behold. It was just a beautiful thing. And I don't know about you, but I have not been able to stop looking at the images from the other marches around the world, including freaking Antarctica.
Yeah. Wasn't that amazing?
Every single continent had a march.
Isn't that great? Oh my God.
It is so tremendously historic. Like, it just, I feel just emotional just saying that out loud.
Yeah.
What an amazing day to be a part of.
You know, yes, I felt the same way. I felt honored and
proud,
happy and proud of us.
It was nice to feel proud again.
Yeah, absolutely. It was truly a great feeling to be in this group of totally chilled out, happy, you know, like people
truly
were
joyful
there,
and positive.
Purposeful, but not angry. It was
well,
Yeah, I mean, angry in the abstract sense.
Yeah.
But the actual...
Right, not there to fight.
Not there to fight.
But I have to say, like, there was something that felt really cathartic about chanting with other people in the street. You know, just having your voice be as loud as it possibly could. I mean, there was something there. There was anger there, but it was kind of channeled in a really positive way to be able to just join a chorus of other angry people, not who were, you know, not looking to fight or use violence in any way, but just emote together.
Yes, just to let it be known.
Yeah, just let it rip.
Let it be known, man.
And it really felt, and I know this to be true, there are more of us than them.
Yes. I also felt that I'm going to say this, which is maybe not so, I don't know, maybe won't be so popular, but I keep hearing the news casting this as a protest against Trump. And I know that we came together because Trump was elected. If Hillary had been elected, we wouldn't have done the Women's March.
Right.
But that said, what I really felt strongly about was it was the women finally standing up after millennia of oppression. And I met some wonderful women in the crowd whilst I was standing there for 4 hours listening to the speechifying. And at one point, this woman, Eileen, and I looked at each other and I said, I'm just so effing sick of these middle-aged white men. Just like, who are they? Who do they think they are that they are telling us what we can do with our bodies, what kind of money we can make? I mean, all of that stuff. I'm just so over it. And that was where I mean, that's the anger that I feel. And it's not even about Trump. It's about that. It's about women's rights. It's about being trampled over and over again and silenced and otherwise treated as second-class citizens when we own half of the world. You know, it's just not right. And I felt like somehow everybody was on that page. And I also really hope that the people who take away from that march are... Trump isn't going to notice one way or the other. He doesn't give a shit. But the other guys, the other middle-aged white men in Congress, they're the ones that I want to reach. They are the ones that I feel really need to have this message hammered home. And when I go back down to D.C. in February, you know, it turns out you can just wander around the halls of Congress and go into anyone's office you want to and tell them whatever you want to tell them. Did you know that?
I did not know that, and I find it really hard to picture it. But
well, I did.
Why didn't we do that yesterday?
Well, because probably none of them were in their offices.
Well, that's true.
But yeah, you can actually go into you get checked out. They look to see if you have any weapons on you, and then you can literally just walk around, drop into an office, and either write down something that you want to tell your representative or any representative, or tell their staff. But that's your right as a citizen. You can actually do that for yourself. And I think more people not only just call your congressional representatives, but anytime you're in D.C., drop in on a few of those bastards and tell them what you think about, you know, dismantling the ACA or not paying women the equal amount of money as men are paid. I mean, yeah. I think that stuff, you know, that's putting a face to an idea is a powerful way
too.
To send a message.
So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest takeaways yesterday is everyone was talking about like how there was this amazing collective gathering of people, but we have to figure out a way to harness this energy and this momentum and sustain it. So, I mean, there does have to be sort of a systematic way to keep reminding these people in Congress that they do work for us.
That's right.
And that's the message that I feel like is not getting across to them at this point. There are representatives. We are their constituents. Yeah. I don't understand what their obsession is with dismantling women's rights. I don't understand what that is. At this point, at this day and age, at this year, it makes absolutely no sense.
And I don't understand why Democrats are not standing up more strongly against that tidal wave of Republican, you know.
And like you said, that rally was not about Trump or just about Trump, but this election was especially painful because we all expected the first woman to be elected president, and instead we got a pussy grabber.
Yeah.
And that hurts.
Yes. It's just horrible.
It is. It's really horrible. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's the embarrassment, the sort of collective American embarrassment over having a con man in the office of presidency is well, at least two-thirds of us, I think, probably feel that embarrassment. And the other third like him.
I know. And I hope, you know, I know all of the world was participating yesterday, but I really hope there was a spotlight on the United States that we were able to show the rest of the world is the majority of us did not vote for this man. This is not who we are. And America Ferrera was one of the rally speakers, and I thought she did a tremendous job when she said, you know, Congress is not America. The president is not America.
That's right.
We are America. Which is also funny because her name's America, because she could have been like, I am America.
Yeah.
And also we are America.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were talking about some of the chants and how enjoyable and cathartic it was to participate
Speaking
in those.
Speaking of soys and jarros.
Yeah.
Well, I just said that totally weird. Joys and sorrows. Yeah.
Yeah. Soys and jarros. I kind of like that.
Sounds like an Asian Chinese fusion dish.
Yeah, totally. Like, I'd like that for lunch. Thank you.
I know. I'm kind of hungry now.
I may never be able to say it the other way now.
Oh, sorry.
But the chants were really great. And they were so clever.
Yeah, the chants were great. The posters were great.
And the signs were great. Oh, my God. My daughter did an incredible sign.
She's such a great artist.
She is so good. And she had she painted a portrait of Trump with a crumpled piece of paper that he was shredding. It was the First Amendment.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was brilliant. I was just like, and she's only 20 and she's already doing stuff like this.
Yeah, you know, there were so many young people.
I loved that.
There were kids. And I saw and heard that a lot of the young people were the chant leaders. You know, I think that they were really getting a kick out of being able to say something out loud and have people holler back at them, and they were really feeling empowered in that moment.
They were. We want a leader, not a creepy tweeter.
Yes. But there was a lot of like, show me what democracy looks like.
Yeah,
this is what democracy. Yeah. And it did. It was like, this is what democracy looks like. And it was cool that a lot of times it was like a 12-year-old who was like, show me what democracy looks like. And I was happy for them that, you know, they're so young and they're going to be impacted by this presidency, and they're going to always remember what it was like, but they will always have that memory too of being amongst millions of people worldwide collectively just taking to the streets. It's so historic.
Taking to the streets and taking to the streets peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
That
Not
was
a single
just
arrest.
A beautiful moment. Yeah. That's
unbelievable.
Yeah. That is something you really have to, you know, consider as a triumph in and of itself.
Yeah. I had a moment, I don't know if you had this as well. I was kind of following a certain path, and it felt like we were heading to the White House, just the route. And then at one point we got kind of as far as one could get towards the White House, but there was a barrier.
Uh-huh.
And then it sort of seemed like out of nowhere, all these Secret Service and policemen rolled up. And I was like, oh, what's this going to be? And people were chanting, and they were like, you work for us. You work for us. And
oh,
I was
wow.
like, oh, no, is this going to be the showdown? But, you know, nothing happened.
Nothing happened. People just turned around, went the other way, probably.
Yeah, because people were going every single direction. I mean, nobody was looking to start a confrontation there.
Yeah.
And the policemen and the Secret Service, they were doing their job.
Sure.
And I have to think that in a city like D.C., where 95% of the people voted against Trump, those policemen did as well.
We saw a lot of smiles. At one point, when we marched across the mall to go up Constitution Avenue towards the Washington Monument, there was suddenly out of nowhere this phalanx of mounted policemen on those giant police horses, mm-hmm. which are bigger than almost any normal horse I've ever seen. They showed up, but everybody cheered for them.
Yeah.
That was the thing that was so
cool.
Great. It was like people were like clapping and cheering for them because, I don't know, because they were there.
Yeah.
It was like, and they
making
were
making sure no one got hurt.
Right. They were smiling. You know, you could definitely. And the other thing was like in the subway when we were leaving, they just let us in for free. And this woman,
oh, cool.
It was so sweet. I mean, the woman there was like, you know, thanking us for doing it. I mean, it was really, I got a lot of that, you know, from even just in the rest stops on the way back from Washington yesterday, the rest stops were overflowing, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And the traffic was unbelievable on the way back up from D.C. And even the bathroom attendants were like, you know, cheering the ladies in their pink pussy hats. I mean, it was wonderful. It was just, it was so heartwarming.
I know. Can we do that every week?
Well, I said, you know, at one point I said, I think we need to do this at least every year.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do it every month, but I think we can do it every year, and I think we should and we must.
Yes.
And I also really appreciate that the American electorate, judging by the turnout at these marches in the United States at least, is recognizing the danger that we face collectively as a nation. and that there is a newly energized segment of the population that will, as you and I were just talking about, actually start holding Congress accountable instead of not paying attention, being asleep at the wheel, as we have been basically for decades. I mean, speaking personally, I think when I first started to reawaken to politics, after having been quite a little activist in my youth, was under the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I swore to myself at that point when he was reelected, I just thought, you know, I got to get busy here. Of course I didn't, except that I started like paying more attention. I didn't do anything like call my, you know, elected representatives or anything. But, and then during the Obama administration, I didn't really have anything to complain about. I mean, I could have, I suppose, been complaining about the drones, but other than that, was there something we should have been complaining about? Expanded powers of the NSA, maybe? I'm trying to think back. Like, what did he do bad? Yeah. But, you know, now it's a new dawn.
Well, if there is any sort of silver lining or takeaway, I guess, it's that, you know, during the Obama administration, there have been tensions and there have been issues that have been building up and we weren't paying close attention.
Right.
And there's no way to look away anymore. And, you know, this is where our media, the responsibility is really going to fall to them to just show up and keep just
and tell
being
the truth.
Diligent about the truth and the facts and what is happening. And we have to keep paying attention. And we just, silence is not acceptable anymore. And like silence is actually violence at this point.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Absolutely. What was I going to say? I can't remember now. I had some other deep thought to impart to you, but I've now, unfortunately, due to my scrambled egg state, I'm...
we're both a little exhausted from the march yesterday.
Yeah, and the drive, which
and the
was
drive, yeah.
Brutal. Absolutely brutal. Yeah. But anyway, well, it's almost 12:30, so let's talk a little bit about we were going to segue from like solidarity in community in the march to solidarity in community in the world of food and how, you know, binding us together in communities now through this awakened interest or awakened concern about our political future. I think I'm trying to find that metaphor that will segue us into what you want to do with radio.
Yeah, well, I love the way that you're framing it. I'm like, tell me more about this. This interesting concept.
Making it up is like,
yes,
on.
That.
Yeah, but I think, you know, there's the way to bind people together with common ideas, common ideals, and commonalities. So a commonality is food. And so
certainly,
bringing together people whose backgrounds and thoughts might be different from yours through the vehicle of food.
Exactly. It's,
of shared...
it's such a great tool that we all, I mean, yeah, everybody eats, so we all have that in common. And, you know, when we're looking at ways to connect with other people and try and, you know, gain some access into who you might be or he or she might be who come from, you know, various different backgrounds, like a great way to approach that is just, well, how do you eat?
Yeah,
because we all have that. It's all we all inherently have in our culture, our food ways. And I think, you know, in a place like New York City, which is just such a perfect example, like, you know, we are that melting pot. And it is a place that's just, you know, historically liberal. And I think it is because we have every single kind of person under the sun,
yes,
like literally living on top of each other.
Yeah.
This city, in contrast to some other places that are not quite as diverse, we have an understanding of each other. And we have a respect for each other and each other's cultures. Not to say that there isn't, of course, you know,
some tensions,
yes,
exist.
But some tensions exist. But we do have much more of a communal way of living together. And I think it's because we have every kind of food here. So if I could see, I can see someone, you know, walking down the street and they come from a different culture than I do. And that's clear and that's evident. But I may already have an understanding and a way in to who they are as a person because I have eaten in their restaurants. I have tasted their food. I have joined them in their rituals of baking, breaking bread.
Yeah.
And I think that that's just like a great first step to kind of understanding and either mitigating or
unifying.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, in this political climate, we all want to look at ourselves and say, like, what do I have to bring to the table? Mm-hmm. You know, how can I use the tools and the resources that I already have at my disposal to help enact change? And we may not all be activists, and that's okay, but what can we do?
Right.
Just having conversations.
About inclusiveness, mm-hmm. right? Isn't Absolutely. That what it's for? So that, I mean, in order to move the body politic in any direction that we, you know, collectively decide is the direction we want to go in, one way of making all those disparate cultures come together is through being able to identify the things that we like about each other. And food is obviously going to be one of them, one of the top ones. And it is, as you say, it's a window into who they are, what their culture is. And I have to say that I have, you know, I love New York City so much, and I've lived here for such a long time, 40-something years. Is it 40 years? Yeah, almost 40 years. 40 years in August. And I was never more proud of New York than after September 11th. Mm-hmm. Because of that very experience of we were all New Yorkers, no matter where we came from, no matter what language we spoke. And I feel like that sense of collective unity within the city has never left us since there. Right? If there was ever a gift from 9/11, I think that was it. At least it was for me, was the sense of that we are one big, you know, maybe not so happy family, but pretty happy family here. And as you say, part of that comes from our collective enjoyment of each other's cuisines.
Yeah. I mean, there was so much hateful and harmful rhetoric that occurred during the election.
Yeah.
And this new administration has been working very hard to try and get us just use this very divisive language to try and get us to really fear each other and yes. be very distrustful of those who don't look
the same.
Like the same.
Yeah.
And I think that food can be a really powerful tool to sort of dissuade some of those feelings.
Well, it breaks down barriers. I mm-hmm. mean, when you sit down at the table to eat with somebody, you're busy with your hands, your fork, your knife, and your mouth, and you know you can't be bothered. You can't be you're not distracted by the things that are different. You're connected by the things that you do the same. And then that, I think, allows people to be more connected in other ways.
Yeah.
At least I would like to think so.
I think so, too. And I think, you know, New Yorkers and other cities, for sure, like there's such a curiosity that's been happening, like amongst food trends. We're all sort of craving authenticity. We want to understand the stories. We want to know where this food comes from. Mm-hmm. We want to understand the lineage and heritage behind this food and have those experiences that really bond us together as people. You know, that can occur at the dinner table. I think, you know, let's open our homes to each other. Let's sit down. Let's share a meal. Only good things, only positive things can come out of that experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the concept is to try and connect with other people who come from other places and just listen to them and like, let's use food as a way to connect. Let's talk about recipes and stories. I mean, we all have
traditions.
We all have memories. We all have traditions. We all have rituals. You know, let's just start opening the door and discussing those.
I love that idea. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I truly do.
Oh, thanks, Katie.
I do. I wish you great success with that.
Thanks.
I can't wait to see what it turns out to be. It's going to be fun.
Me too.
And yeah, right? So you'll have guests on from different backgrounds and different cultures.
Yeah.
How are you going to find them, do you think?
I'm not sure yet. I mean, you know, it's like you said, it's New York City. It's a melting pot. It can't be that difficult.
I mean,
just putting the call out.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I think there's a lot of organizations that are doing amazing work and helping to resettle refugees. And I think a lot of people come here and they come armed with their recipes and their stories and their memories. And they're going to want to talk about it.
Oh, my God. That's a gorgeous concept, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just getting refugees to come in and talk. Mm-hmm. And what a way to welcome them to America, you know, to say, I really am interested. I value your contributions to our country and I'm excited to see what you bring with you.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to provide a platform for people to kind of talk about where they're from and then use this common language of food to connect, at least in this space in Heritage Radio, because that's what we do here.
That's what we do, because we are the Heritage Radio Network. Mm-hmm. It's 12:35. Are we done? Should we go on to
Are you asking
topic?
Me? Are you asking the guy in the booth?
No, I mean, I'm just like being slightly brain dead. I'm like, what else can we talk about? I don't know. We haven't seen each other in a while.
True.
You know, oh, I know. Let's talk about media again for a minute.
Okay.
Because that's another story. I mean, the food story, I'm going to get on my little hobby horse now.
Oh, good.
Because food and politics, you know, which is what normally I talk about on this show. you know, I want to see more of that coming out of the march that we just, you know, I always see everything through that lens anyway. And I want to see more people becoming aware of how their food choices are being manipulated by agencies outside of, even outside of elected officials.
That's
by
a really
lobbying.
Hard thing to see if you're not already quite intimately familiar with the way things work.
Yeah.
From the top down.
Well, it's such a complex series of problems and interconnections. And my last guest, Molly Anderson from Middlebury, was really excellent in trying to parse out, tease out those connections and trying to create a sort of a basic framework for people to begin to understand how connected food is to politics. It's not ancillary to politics. It kind of drives our politics in a lot of ways. And we talked quite a bit about the export orientation of this country in terms of how we raise food, what we raise, how we price it, and so forth. And there's so much of our, you know, the narrative of we have to feed 9.5 billion people or, you know, 9 billion more people in 2050 is driven by these food companies that say, well, it's all on us to do it. But we aren't doing it. We aren't even doing it for our own people. So what we're doing is raising things that make money for other people rather than actually providing food and sustenance, nutrition, basic nutrition for all of us as well as other people around the world. And that's, I mean, in a way, that's sort of my goal for the next year is to just look for ways to because I think in a way, are we the only one? I mean, I live in a bubble, but are we the only ones that don't have food policy? Are we the only ones who just blindly consume without ever thinking about where it comes from? We're that, I mean.
We as an American?
As Americans, yeah. Do you think we're the only ones who are as disconnected from our food as we are? I mean.
I think we're certainly disconnected from our terroir more than other countries are.
I feel like other countries seem to pay more attention to food. Certainly in the EU, I think, you know, the French, the Italians, and the Germans, the Spaniards, the English, not so much. They're more like us, I think.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing because when you go over to the EU, you sort of see the pendulum swinging the opposite direction. I think during the Obama administration, they certainly shone a spotlight on food policy, and obviously, like, nutrition played such a major role in the White House. And of course, we had Michelle Obama as an amazing champion of nutrition. And there seemed to be more of a shift, just like a general collective shift in that direction. And I went to France during grad school where I studied food studies, and we were sort of aghast to see how much our Western influence had sort of pervaded their food culture.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, and then, you know, seeing young people everywhere eating chips out of a bag. And, you know, we kind of went in with these preconceived notions that everyone in France just walks around with, like, picking out fresh vegetables as they walk down the street and, like, snacking on nothing but, like, cheese and baguettes and shopping at a farmer's market every single day. And we were pretty horrified to get there and find out that wasn't the case anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were kind of moving in one direction in this country, and they were sort of moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah. I don't know. I got the feeling that they're still pretty connected to the food.
Certainly more so than we are. But I don't feel very hopeful about the direction this new administration will take us in.
Oh, no. I mean, Mr. Fast Food himself, Cittadini. I mean,
yeah.
That's what he likes. That's what he cares about. And I don't know anything about the new Secretary of Agriculture. I have to do some homework on him, but
it's not good.
It doesn't sound like a good picture.
I think the White House garden will be the first casualty.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That and, you know, as well as all of the nutrition programs that have been put into place, they won't get any more funding.
No.
Anyway. Well, I think on that sad note, we should probably wrap it up because I'm starving.
Gotta go get a Big Mac.
That's right. Gotta go get my chips.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was nice
me.
To have, like, somebody to debrief about the march with.
Yeah. You know?
That was really great. And for those of you who weren't able to attend a march, we were there for you.
Absolutely.
We were totally there for you. And let's do it every year, folks. And let's keep our eyes and ears really closely trained.
And in the meantime, just Just keep it up.
Make
just
the
keep
calls.
Calling.
Make
keep
the calls.
Calling.
Unfortunately,
writing, calling.
I'm senile, so I can't remember the name of, the phone number of Congress, but it was pretty easy to remember, as I recall.
It definitely started with 202.
202, something, something, 2131. Yeah.
I think it was 255. I don't want to say the wrong one.
Yeah, right. But look it up. And then just tell them your zip code, and they'll tell you, send you to the right guy. So
yeah.
Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks to my sponsor, New York Grown and Certified. Did I say it right, Vitor? Yes. New York State Grown and Certified. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back next week for another great episode. And until then, have a good week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.